We individualize training in the pool, so why not individualize your nutrition? Erica Biney of Biney Wellness Building will help you and your swimmers get exactly what each athlete needs through genetic testing and personalized nutrition plans. So stop guessing what you should and shouldn't be putting into your body. Athletes within a few weeks have noticed they're recovering faster because they're fueling their body with what they need and staying away from what their body hates. Erica understands swimming. She gets it. She's worked with over 20 Olympians, including the fastest man in the world, Caleb Dressel. Group discounts are available, so go to Biney Wellness Building and get in touch with Erica today. That's Biney, B-E-I-N-E, wellnessbuilding.net. All right, Gary Hall Jr., welcome to the podcast, my friend. How are you?
Good, Brett. Doing good.
It's good to see you again, man. A lot of people have been calling for this one. You know, you and I have talked many times, but you haven't been on the Inside with Brett Hawk podcast. So people have been demanding it.
I've been waiting a long time. Am I guest 1027 or wait, how far down on the list?
I'm how sorry. Low of a priority? I'm yeah. sorry I pushed you that far. I apologize.
Okay, it's okay. No, it's just the anticipation has been building for so long. It's finally here. I'm like climaxing.
Well, we can open up then. We can just talk about whatever we want to talk about. So I'm actually going to take a different approach with you. I go along the same lines with people, but I'm going to try something different today. How about this? I'm going to say a name or a phrase, and I'm just going to get your first reaction. You're just going to go with it, and we'll just see where the conversation leads. How's that sound?
Yeah, that sounds good. Name association game. Good.
Perfect. I tried to pick out some highlights of your life here. So I'm going to start with a big one. I'm going to start with Gary Hall Sr.
Father. Do I do a one-word response or do you want me to elaborate?
Well, we're going to make this a conversation. So you go as deep as you can on this one.
I thought it might be rapid fire where you just do one-word response. First thing that jumps to mind.
No way.
Okay. He was obviously a huge influence in my life, as most dads are. He was a world-class swimmer, 10 world records, world swimmer of the year twice, carried the flag for the United States. The only other swimmer to do that is Michael Phelps in the Olympic Games. He met my mother, who was a swimmer, at a swim meet, at a swimming pool that my grandfather built. A lot of heritage in the sport, and definitely as a youngster was cognizant of his influence.
Well, you've got brothers, correct?
I've got two brothers and three sisters. I'm the oldest of six, yeah.
So why you? You're the spawn of this legend. But I would argue that your father is a legend, but you became an icon. Like you always went to a different level than your father. Your father's one of the greatest swimmers in history, don't get me wrong. But you are at iconic level. So how did you, why you? Why this son?
You know, I think that there's a lot of pressure in sharing the same name as my father. And it was a lot that I had to deal with in order to be successful in the sport. And then once I was successful in the sport, you can double that pressure on my younger siblings, right? So I think that my brothers had an expectation, not just to match up to my father, but to me. And so that was unfair to them. That pressure wasn't coming from me or from my father, but the big shoes to fill, and those expectations do come from teammates or coaches. And so, I think that they dealt with a bit of that. So that was a luxury that I guess I only had to deal with the comparisons to my father.
Are you a lot like your father in terms of the comparisons? Are they fair?
No, I'm not like my father. In some ways, yes, we are all like our father in some ways, but we are very different in a lot of ways. I've always identified as a very right brain thinker. I think my father is just more of a left brain thinker, if I can oversimplify it.
Your father was academic too. He's a doctor. So were you being pushed into any academia as a kid, as well as the swimming, to kind of chase that side of things?
No. In fact, I think at one time at the end of my high school career, he was so disenfranchised with the American medical system, frivolous lawsuits, and everything that can go wrong, and obviously was brought into highlight, rising drug prices, insurance reimbursement, all the things, that he was not encouraging me to go into medicine. In fact, he was discouraging.
Wow. Okay. Now, what about your mother? What kind of influence did mom have on you?
Yeah, I love my mom. I love my mom. Yeah, she's been great. You know, through all of the Olympic journey, you know, so much of the attention was focused on my father. And very few people kind of asked about my mom along the way. And I think I inherited a lot from her. That made me ultimately a little more successful, at least at the Olympic Games, than my father.
Like what? Like, give me some examples of some things that you got from your mom that you think helped you in those big moments.
I think that she has the ability to stubborn is not the right word. But determined. I think that she's one of the most determined people that I've ever met, and knows how to take that determination and work with others. You know, that she never wanted the spotlight, that she kind of played a supportive role through all that media attention on what my father had contributed to my success as a swimmer. You know, did it quietly, and she's Midwest stock. She was, you know, on my mother's side of the family, Cincinnati, Ohio. So those are, you know, modest, hardworking, humble people, and with a self-deprecating sense of humor. And I think I inherited, you know, a lot of that. You know, she was always the one that, you know, could one keep me in check, because she could had the ability to reason, even though she can be, you know, determined, and that she had that ability to compromise and find some reason. And also that expands upon an ability to pivot, which is critical in a high stakes competition. You know, there are always going to be unexpected factors that come in play, and how we can respond to these influences greatly determines how successful we can be out of it.
Was it a normal upbringing for you, in terms of, like, normal in the sense that, you know, when I grew up swimming, my parents knew nothing about swimming, so they kind of stayed out of it. How did your parents influence your swimming career?
Well, they forced us to swim at one point. My father and grandfather built the Phoenix Swim Club in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was placed between where we lived and where we went to school. I'm the oldest of 31 cousins on my mother's side, and we all lived within 10 miles of each other. So it's basically like a daycare center for a lot of the family. Wow. And it was just where we spent every single day after school, before school, once we started doing doubles. A big family oriented program. They were very influential in making me swim. They did, I have to say, to be fair to them, they gave me the option at one point, you can either go get a job or you can continue swimming. And there was so much emphasis on swimming. So you asked earlier about academics and stuff like that. I could skate by in school as long as I was showing up to practice and committing myself that way. Very influential. I went as far as one time applying for a job scooping ice cream, and I got the job. And I remember being in the laundry room when I took the phone call, and they said, "Congratulations, you've got the job." And the reality that I was going to be scooping ice cream instead of swimming sank in at that moment, and I quit on the spot. Like, it is the way that I responded. They were like, "You, congratulations, you got the job." And I said, "I quit." And I went to practice that afternoon. So that was one of the close calls where I almost left the sport.
You almost went into Ben and Jerry's for life. Wow.
Yeah.
We could have lost you. That's crazy. Were they critiquing your races at that time?
No. No, thank God. You know, he's running the race club. He's considered a technical expert, you know, stroke mechanics and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Really takes that scientific approach to everything that he's doing there. But he never tried to coach us, thank God. It just would not have worked. I would not have reacted well to that.
Did they come to every swim meet, or was it sporadic?
No. Yeah, I'd see him at the pool. He'd come from eye surgery. He was an ophthalmologist and practiced for 25 years. And he'd come in his lunch break and swim in the master's group. So I'd see him there sometimes, regularly. But no, he went to the big meets.
Yeah, normal. Okay. All right. Just trying to get a feel for this. So I got a pretty good understanding now. So when did this all start to click then? When did you start to realize that you were pretty good at this thing and that you were on kind of this Olympic track? When did that happen?
There was my junior year in high school. I was relatively late to the sport. I didn't really start swimming until summer after eighth grade. So like 14, around then, 13, 14.
Like training.
Yeah, and then it was all in. Like, I quickly went into doubles and was making up ground, training with Pierre LaFontaine, who's a distance coach. I was definitely making up ground, but there was no indication that I would be an Olympic swimmer or even good until state meet junior year in high school. I placed second, and it was really, even though I placed second, I think a realization for my parents more than me that I could be good. And it was the summer after my junior year that I had a big breakthrough swim at junior nationals and became my top recruit for colleges that year, following year. So I didn't think up until that summer after my junior year that I would swim in college. I wasn't good enough.
Were you always the Gary Hall that we know now? Like, even back then when you first started swimming, did you have, I'm sure you had the charisma you always have. You have that from birth. But, you know, if people were to think back on 14, 15-year-old Gary Hall Jr., what do you think they would say about that kid?
He's going to end up in jail.
Really?
Yeah.
It was just oh, wild. Yeah, definitely.
I was on a path.
Really? Like yeah. Skipping school? What were you doing? Doing it all.
I was arrested a few times. Just mischievous stuff.
What was that from, you think? Like, why were you doing that at that time, do you think? Like, if you think back to...
My grandpa went to prison. And I was affected. I had a lot of anger. So I started going to therapy. I was forced to, a court order type of thing. When I was sleeping and I punched a wall in my sleep and broke my hand and had to have it treated. And they were asking me all these like questions, like how did this happen and stuff like that. And when I told them, like they like mandated that I start going to see like a therapist and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I mean, I was a troublemaker. I was a troublemaker. And I had a lot of energy, dark energy. And so swimming became a really healthy outlet, a way to take dark energy and put it in a positive direction.
Was it the training you connected with or the competing more so?
Oh, the competing. And that was real early. I was terrible. I had a swim meet in Glendale, Arizona. It was freezing outside. I didn't want to be there. And halfway through a 200 race, I locked eyes with a guy that was about a body length ahead of me, and something clicked. That like moment. And I said, I'm going to beat that guy. And just started, you know, chasing him down. And if you had asked me prior to that breath where I made that decision, if I was given 100%, I would have said, yes, definitely giving 100%. But I found another gear once that click happened and realized that racing is different than training. And that that's what I loved. And so all the training was never really, I didn't like it that much, but it was necessary in order to do the racing that I loved. And so, you know, I got through it.
That's the guy I want to track down. Who's the guy that triggered Gary Hall? That's the one.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it was an epic race. It came stroke for stroke down to touch, and I barely out-touched him, and it was for like 67th place at like a rinky dink swim meet. And he probably hung it up a long time ago. They say the smart ones get out.
Well, what I'm interested in is we all know about Atlanta and kind of what went on there. And we'll talk a bit about that. But how did you get to Atlanta? How did you get through your first Olympic trials? Who did you have to beat? Who were the people at that time?
I had to beat Tom Jagger, who was my hero. I mean, if I had a hero in the sport, Tom Jagger was the guy. And I it wasn't until I got to know Tom, because I was training in Phoenix with Troy Dalby, who was an 88 Olympian and a Hellraiser himself too. He was one of the guys that notoriously was arrested in Korea, disgraced the United States in some Ryan Lochte. He pulled the Ryan Lochte before Ryan Lochte. And he was the master's coach at the Phoenix Swim Club. And I was training with him a bit, and Troy knew Tom. And so introduced me at a Santa Clara meet or some, you know, some swim meets and stuff. And so it wasn't until I got to know Tom that I really, that he became a real influence on me. And then obviously I became aware of, you know, the Dash for Cash and the races with Matt Biondi and his efforts to professionalize the sport and the vision that he had at the time that he instilled in me really kind of brought to my attention, like, hey, we could be doing a better job marketing the sport. Creating more professional opportunities for the athletes, that type of stuff. And I still really respect Tom to this day.
But you did have to get over the top of him to make that team. You had to beat him. So yeah, how was that possible? And,
I was pretty brash. I knew what I was going for. I knew what I wanted at that time, and knew I could take it. I still had to do it, but I had hoped that we would make the team together. I ended up doing really well at those trials.
Who was it then? Who was first and second in the 50? Who was first and second in the 100 for the US?
David Fox was the other guy in the 50. Mm-hmm. And let's see, in the 100, it was maybe John Olson.
Okay.
I think it was John.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. So then, here's my next big name for you, Alex Popov.
Yeah. The Russian rocket.
This is where you, this isn't the first time you meet him in 96, is it?
No. I first met him at the World Championships in 1994. They were in Rome, and reigning Olympic champion, world record holder. And I didn't meet him before the ready room, before finals, really. He made an approach, came in, went directly up to me and you know, started saying some things like, oh, what's the medal count for the United States right now? Is this a trick question? I'm not paying attention. I've got attention deficit disorder. You know, like, don't ask me. There's got to be a team manager who can give you the medal count if you're really interested. And yeah, I didn't even know if it was like broken English or anything. And so he's asking me a rhetorical question because obviously he already knew the answer. He's like, 13 or something. He's like, never before at the World Championships has the United States been so far behind in the medal count. or so low in the medal count or something like that. I was like, oh, interesting. And still trying to like figure out if he didn't speak English or like this was social etiquette where he's from. I don't know. And then he's like, well, you know, don't expect to win anymore or something like that. And he like made another comment that I was like, wow. And so right off the bat, I didn't like him. And he went on to say, you know, that I come from a family of losers and you know, was referencing my father because my father never won a gold medal at the Olympic Games. You know, this is like the first time anybody in the world of swimming was like, your dad's a bad guy, or like he came up short, or what a failure. Wow. So, there was no love lost between us. I didn't like him. He did not like me. And he came after me because he knew that I was a threat. That was my indoctrination into the sport and the ready room. I was like, oh, wow. Psychology is kind of a big thing here. I wasn't able to articulate that as a teenager, but like, wow, okay, you want to play head games? That's okay. That's part of this circuit. Okay. and so in some ways, I think it ended up being beneficial to me in the long run because, you know, it takes a long time to figure that stuff out.
Yeah.
And learn how to play it or play to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, I've got my own Gary Hall Jr. story coming up later in the podcast. So based on that, but, so 96 then, so how do you go in then with the confidence that you had in 96? I mean, you're at a home Olympics in Atlanta, you are racing the Russian rocket, the guy that's trying to get into your head. He's in great form, but you have incredible confidence and it's oozing out of the television screen for the kid back home watching. I'm not really a kid, but I was watching back home in Sydney, Australia, but you know, your confidence was oozing out of the television. How did you have that at that particular point in time?
Well, I had enough international experience with the world championships in 94. I placed second to Popov in both the 50 and the 100 freestyle. Not by much. And then won two golds in the relays there. And then went to the Pan Pacific Championships the following year and won four gold medals. And so I had enough of a taste of what it feels like to win that I felt like I was poised to be a contender, to you know, that it was going to come down to a few people. And I always kind of recognized that there were eight finalists, but you only had to really worry about two or three. And I knew Popov was great. But I felt that he was beatable. And I don't know. But you talk about the oozing confidence part. I felt confident, but everybody experiences like the doubts stuff, the doubt. And questioning, you know, worthiness to win, some, you know, deep stuff goes into processing and I think that ultimately it affects our psyche and our psychology and how, do I deserve to win? Like big questions. I felt like I was ready by 96, physically capable of it. But all the showmanship stuff, like the bravado, flexing and stuff like that, I was doing that a long time before, you know, back before I was even a good swimmer. So what was portrayed in the media is, oh, all this bravado and self-confidence and you know, showmanship and, you know, swagger and, you know, he's the bad boy of swimming because, you know, it, all that stuff, I hated it. I hated it. And in some ways, even though it was done jokingly as a mediocre swimmer, you know, in high school, swim meets doing similar things with stick arms, you know, before I had any muscle on me at all, kissing my biceps was a funny thing. And then, you know, so I was just a continuation of something that I'd been doing behind the blocks for a long time. It's just the media portrayal. And I sympathize with NBC's role to try to sum up a person in a minute and 30 seconds, you know, the profile pieces that they do before an Olympic finals that they run. They can't really dive into who this person is. And so they kind of latch on to, oh, this is the brash, showman. I felt like that was just a very narrow window of a more complex personality. And I never really appreciated that. I appreciated the fact that I was selected because they don't select very many people that they do those profile pieces on. That reputation. And there's a formula too. So if you look at the 92 Olympics too, they select about a dozen athletes, the television coverage, right? And from multiple sports. And there's almost like a stereotype that they'll like try to fill, like, oh, this is the very confident, this is the quiet stoic type, this is the one that overcame some hardship. So there's like personality or mm-hmm. obstacle overcome stereotypes that they'll always kind of do and just swap out the individuals. It's like they have a team together and identify who's going to be like, you know, the bleeding heart story, who's going to be the cocky showman guy. I felt fortunate to be getting the exposure, but never like being pigeonholed.
So for you then, that wasn't manufactured. It wasn't like, okay, I'm going to be on television, this is going to be a way. It was just you being you. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I was always a goofball. I mean, horsing around and just laughing about it. And there were, that was kind of what made it fun too, was that there was like a group of friends back home watching that were all in on the joke and were just like laughing. It was funny. And it was, you know, at the time in 96, World Wrestling Association or whatever, the wrestling was like way more popular than any Olympic sport. And that was all entertainment. You know, these guys are steroid idiots, not athletes really. And look at the television ratings. And so it hit me that sport is entertainment, and that how do we better market our sport to create better professional opportunities for the swimmers? Yeah. It's going to benefit all swimmers. So there was some realization, at least awareness, that this is getting a response with the media and stuff. Let's play to it. And truthfully, I had a lot of fun playing to it. I mean, it was a fun character to play that was half based in world wrestling entertainment. Showmanship, P.T. Barnum style. You know,
I loved it, man. I loved it. I'll tell you what, it sold me. I was into it. I couldn't wait to see more.
Tired of settling for less than the best with your team's dryland program? Swimstrong Dryland is the answer you've been looking for. With world-class dryland programming for every age group, customized to fit your team's needs, nutritional coaching and education centered on the latest evidence-based research, leadership training and character development to promote an athlete-driven culture, sports psychology education and mental skills training, coaches' corners to promote collaboration, data-driven performance analysis, and an unrivaled family of athletes, coaches, and teams, Fast Swimming starts here.
But so was there any more of that pop off then trying to get into your head at the Olympics then? Was there anything behind the scenes?
It went back and forth. It went back and forth. I beat him in two Olympic games and he beat me in one. And, we were real selective on times. Like I invited him after the 96 Olympics to the Phoenix Grand Prix meet that we were hosting. and he did not want to race me. You know, he wanted some outrageous amount of money to show up, and but he didn't. When we crossed paths at a swim meet, it was rare, and it was intense, and it was real. That was a real rivalry, and a lot of people did notice. A lot of people did. You know, I still, it's one of the top questions. You know, tell me a pop-off story. Or, you know, like what. Was that real, or, you know, were you just horsing around like the shadow boxing stuff?
Yeah, no, it felt genuine, you know, for sure. And you know, I knew Alex pretty well. He was obviously living in Australia, and there were times when we'd train with him, and, you know, occasionally your name would come up, and you know, he had similar feelings that I'm sure that you have about him, you know, in terms of that. The rivalry seems real. He didn't like you, and I don't think you liked him, and it showed up in the racing, you know?
Yeah, you definitely find, you know, more motivation for training. You know, it pushes you, even though we didn't race that often, you know, it definitely pushed me in training. I wanted it more to be the one to take him down. But it's interesting because it wasn't until I learned to respect him that I was able to beat him.
Ah, interesting. Talk to me about that a little bit more.
Well, just what is he doing right? Let's really break that down. What, you know, let's learn from that. Let's not try to mimic it. Let's try to improve upon it.
Sure.
We're not the same. I knew that. I mean, I knew. It, you know, you'd hear stories about, you know, some legendary set that he did or something, you know, the time that he went and practiced or something like that. Mm. And, you know, I was a totally different swimmer. I was very slow in season and couldn't match him. If I ever did show up, I said, we raced one time, I think in Monaco or something like that. I mean, I was 3 seconds behind in the 50. It wasn't even close.
Why? That's an interesting point you bring up. It's kind of a tangent, but you were terrible in season, like terrible. Like usually most swimmers, they're a little bit off their time. They're like, oh, when I taper, I'm going to be here for confidence sake. I want to be in this range. But like if I swam Gary Hall times in season, I would have zero confidence. For some reason, you would swim terrible in season and still come to the trial meet and be the most confident person there. I'm like, is this guy delusional? Like he's just swam 53 in the 100 free 3 weeks ago. What was behind all that?
It was always the case. I was always slow in season. I just couldn't handle the workload. I'd break down. I was just fatigued all the time. Just physiologically, there was a different, whether it's fast twitch, genetic makeup.
But did it not interest you as well? Like, did you just not care about smaller meets?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, yes, that is true. So I always liked going out to California meets. Growing up, I went to the Mission Viejo meet and the Santa Clara meet and the LA Invitational, the Janet Evans Invitational, the one at USC. As an age group swimmer. And so I loved going back to those meets. But outside of those, you know, I went to the Oklahoma City professional swim meet, I think maybe twice. But other than that, I only went to Olympic trials or trials at nationals. I didn't even go to nationals every year. I was just swimming for one meet. Once I got to the national team, I was only swimming for the Olympic Games. It's the only one I cared about.
That's true, and I saw a lot of that. But isn't it how did you get your confidence then? Like, how did you get your race strategy down pat where you feel like, okay, I just got to fall in the pool and this is going to happen? For me, with that type of strategy of like not caring about certain meets and also being, you know, fully broken down and fatigued and being so far off your best, how were you able to then go through a taper period where all of us as swimmers have those psychological questions in our mind of like, is this going to turn out the way I want it to? Am I going to end up on the 27th of June feeling better than I've ever felt before? Having all those doubts. How did you get to that point then?
I knew that I was always good about listening to my body. I was always very in tune with my body. I knew when I had to push it and when I had to back off. And I took a lot of shit for it from coaches and from teammates too. That year that I went to the University of Texas with Eddie, Eddie never really, he was concerned. He was always very nice about it in a nurturing way, but I was swimming so slow through the midseason of my freshman year at Texas, and the teammates, there were a lot of them that did not like that at all. I had a scholarship, they didn't. Mm-hmm. And so it created some rifts in team dynamic there. Other guys were you know, totally accepting of that. But I had to convince people over time that that's the way I operated. That, you know, mid-season, I'm going to be so slow. I'm buried. I know that there's a method to this madness, and that ultimately, and it wasn't like a hidden agenda. Like, ideally, every swimmer has heard, okay, you're going to go through this phase of being broken down for such a long period of time, and then we're going to rest you, and it's going to have this trampoline springboard effect where you know, are tapered and you have all this energy and you're going to swim great at the end of the season, right? Like that's the common formula. I just took the divot a lot lower than what most people did. And, you know, I think it was, a lot of it, I didn't have a choice. Like, it was just, I would get that broken down.
Do you consider yourself special, different? I mean, you even what you just described is unusual. Like, most athletes don't react that way. Most athletes react more of the way that your teammates at Texas were reacting, where it was work hard, push through, swim really fast in season, and then drop a little bit of time. That's the majority. So how do you categorize yourself? Are you a very gifted athlete in that sense?
No. So there's training and there's racing, and both are technically categorized as freestyle, but it might as well be two different strokes, backstroke to breaststroke, because it's totally different swimming. And if you look at a pie chart, breakdown of time that we dedicate to aerobic conditioning, at least when I was swimming, it's the majority of the pie chart.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that, and you're conditioned through all of that training that every single day in practice, you got 100% effort, right? Coach is telling you, okay, last one, 100% effort on this set. You hear it all the time, 100%, 100%. So you are conditioned to believe that that's 100% what you're doing in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go to the meet and you're asked to do 100%. You've been conditioned to swim the time that you've gone in practice. There's another gear, there's racing. How much of that pie chart that we were talking about is dedicated to recreating specifically the race environment?
Mm.
To me, growing up, there was only one thing that I remember doing that accomplished that, and that was the get out swim. And I don't even hear kids talk about get out swims anymore, but that was the only time where one kid, and Pierre used to do this pretty often, and I loved it. One kid gets up on the blocks, and there's supposedly one last set, right? And everybody gets out of that last set if Jeff can go this time, get out swim.
Sure.
And everybody stops, and everybody's got their anticipation, like, please make the time, please make the time. And everybody's focused on one swimmer, and you got the stopwatch. That was the only thing that mimicked racing. It, all those like lactate sets and stuff, repeat 50s, whatever, that's not racing. That's not anything close to it. In fact, it's detrimental to be training people saying this is 100%. Because that's practice, and then there's racing. And they're two very, very, very different things.
So you always found when the
so that's what I I was good at racing.
Yeah,
that's what I was.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, there's no doubt about that. The 10 Olympic medals will have proven that for sure. But yes, when the spotlight was on Gary Hall Jr., there was something came out of you. Something grew inside of you. There was another level that you were able to get to that all the athletes that we just talked about predominantly weren't able to get to. You got to a superior level of performance than they did.
Yeah. And so a lot of people think that, came up with excuses, right, for themselves. A lot of the swimmers, like, oh, his dad was a great swimmer, genetic inheritance. He's just gifted. He's talented. He doesn't have to work or whatever like that. I was just better at racing than them. Like, and the pressure and dealing with the pressure. So I've watched a few of your podcasts, and you had Bart Kisarowski on, who's a good friend and was a teammate for a lot of those years. And he was talking about how he cracked under that pressure. Now, cracks is a varying scale, right? But it got inside his head. The pressure got inside his head and affected him. And not only has to affect you a little bit, you know, a tenth of a second, hundredth of a second, you know, so just the tiniest little bit, and you're compromised. And so I was very good at being unflappable with the pressure. It didn't mean that I wasn't experiencing it. I was. I definitely felt it. It's so intense. So intense. But I was able to compartmentalize enough to remain focused and not let it interfere with my focus on getting the most out of my
performance. I like that description, actually, compartmentalize. I could never figure out why I was not good under pressure in terms of the Bart Kisarowski, not good under pressure, you know, that 1/10th of a second where it affects you a little bit. Until I started coaching Cesar Cielo, until I started seeing what a person who was so good at compartmentalizing under pressure could do in that moment. He was spectacular, better than any athlete I've ever seen in terms of putting everything else aside for just a moment in time to focus on exactly what he had to do and do it really well. He was brilliant at that, for sure.
So I was diagnosed somewhere along the line with attention deficit disorder. And so I am generally like juggling 3 or 4 thoughts at a time, very hyperactive, not a hyperintelligent mind. And people with this condition have an ability to hyperfocus. Like, so when it is just lock going on and then zeroed in. And then hold like within such intensity. And I see that in Anthony too.
I was going to say that he's on my list of people, the topics that we're going to talk about. But the next big one I want to get to, obviously, as part of your life, is type 1 diabetes. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, diagnosis came out of nowhere. I was training for 2000. I was a year and a half out from 2000 Olympics and was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. It's an autoimmune disease where your pancreas stops producing insulin, the beta cells in there. So you have to give yourself shots of insulin in order to live. And so I was told upon diagnosis by 2 doctors that it was the end of my swimming career. I couldn't compete in the Olympic Games. Nobody had ever done that before. And then it was something that I struggled with. Anybody facing a diagnosis of a potentially life-threatening disease, there's a lot of questions about our mortality, about our purpose, re-examining past assumptions. And so ultimately, what I got out of it in a positive way, a post-traumatic growth thing that happened for me out of that diagnosis was it put swimming in perspective. Like, this is not really that important. I mean, yeah, I've invested a lot of hours into this thing, but at the end of the day, like, if I were to die tomorrow, Did my 21.7 something really change the world, make it a better place? No. So that sounds really negative, but for me, it was a positive because I had always maintained a life outside of sports. So I always kind of had a more of a balanced perspective on what this is,
mm-hmm.
What I'm committing myself to in terms of, swimming. And so I think ultimately that's what elongated my career so much and helped ultimately, like once I got to that high intensity pressure of the Olympic Games, to kind of maintain a perspective that whether you win or lose this race, like you're gonna be all right. Like there's a lot more to life than this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you obviously figured out a way to manage it enough to come back to swimming and do qualify for a couple more Olympics. So that was good news for everybody. I'll give you another name and you go with it. Mike Bottom.
Yeah. Mentor. I mean, he's a genius. an oddball. So I think it connected, in a lot of ways. Not saying that I connected with him on a genius level. I definitely did not. But he graduated near top of his class in psychology. And he used that psychology every single day in a measurable result environment. And I've said this before about him, that any other buddy that goes into practice after getting a psychology degree, the person comes in, sits on the couch, says, "Oh, I feel happier. I feel sadder." How do you spectrum of human emotion, right? Like, how do you measure, what are the measurable results? But Mike was able to take that psychology degree and address things like motivators and demotivators and applied to individuals rather than a blanket team approach, experiment with what works for this individual doesn't work for this individual. And he was one of the first coach that I ever came across that was able to fine tune his approaches based on this psychology insight that he had, to figure out why we tick, what works. I mean, there were some swimmers that he had to scream at, in order to get their best out of them. And if he had tried that with me or with Anthony, that, wasn't going to work. So I don't know. I learned so much from him. I think every swimmer you've had on here has cited their coach as being as influential as their own father in some ways.
Yeah.
He certainly has been to me. He's a dear friend, brother.
Give me an example of a time where, we'll have an example of each, maybe where he got it wrong, where he got it right. Let's start with an example of where he got it right for you. What was something that you remember where you're like, man, I'm glad I had Mike in that moment?
Well, my coaching experience prior to Mike, I had some bad coaches, and Eddie Reese is a great coach, but Mike came in and he was not well known. So in 95, that was when he had this small group he got the most out of the swimmers that he worked with when he was at Auburn under Dave Marsh.
Yep.
And it was just for a short period of time that he was there. And, my father knew Joe Bottom, Mike's older brother, from the Olympic Games. He lost to him by a little bit in 76, 100 butterfly. And Mike was the youngest brother of the Bottom brothers from Santa Clara. And so he knew those guys because he was competing with Mike's older brothers. And so Mike came in and we clicked right away. I had this coach that hated me at the time. And I hated the coach and I was close to quitting, and Mike came in and it didn't take us long. I mean, he's told the story about, our first exchange, like he comes in, first time he sees me swimming and I'm just doing open turns, swimming slow back and forth. I'm not even making like send off times or whatever. I'm just doing open turns, and coach so pissed that I'm doing open turns, and Mike comes running over. He's like, "Oh, that's genius. You know, like why practice, you know, sloppy turns? Like if you can practice it, practice perfect." And I just kind of like smirk, like, okay. I didn't want to tell him that I do open turns because I don't like water going in my ear, which is true. I didn't, my entire career, I did open turns in training because I didn't like water going in my ear. But he gave me like all this like credit, which was totally undeserved. And I was like, oh, well, that's nice of you. Thanks for the effort. I recognized it right away. You know, he was a psychologist. I could see that. You know, I hadn't been in therapy enough that I knew these tactics, right? And so I was amused by it, by the attempt to make that connection with me. And then, you know, but he always went to bat for it, me, you know, like, and you know, was considered an outsider in the sport for a long time because of it. Because there were a lot of people that didn't like me, didn't like what I was doing. And they were running the sport at the time. And so Mike was never named to a coach, like a coaching position on a USA swimming national team, like unbelievably late. I don't know when that was, but it'd be interesting to find out. I think he'd been putting people on Team USA Olympic teams for a long time before they finally like named it to a coaching position on a team.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that for sure. Former swimmers looking for a way to give back to the sport in New York City, reach out to Imagine Swimming. Since 2002, they've been the premier learn to swim school with international and American staff, including Olympic champions Anthony Irvin and Eric Vint. Imagine Swimming offers infant to adult classes, plus competitive team options, water polo, and an artistic swimming club coached by an Olympic silver medalist. With flagship locations across Manhattan and Brooklyn, Imagine is always looking for the next generation of swimmers to pass on their knowledge and passion for swimming. Was it difficult for you in the lead up to 2000 to train with the group that you were training? Because I remember in the lead up to especially 2009, for me, I had Fred Brusquet and Cesar Cielo and a bunch of other athletes. It was almost like a little race club, you know. At Auburn University, we had a very strong professional group of swimmers. George Bovell was there actually. And I didn't get it right all the time. Was it tough for Mike at that point to balance you and Anthony and, you know, Buck Kozorowski and the other guys, you know, because you're all individuals and you all need to be spoken to differently, but you're also balancing egos within the pool as well, right?
Yeah, you know, he was good about not always reeling that in. You know, there's a balance where you want that competitive, charged atmosphere, but you want to stop it before it goes to fisticuffs. You know, like, yeah. and it came close a lot of times. And so he was a master of being able to allow for that kind of competitive interaction, and the stuff, because that's what made us better racers, because we were contending in that environment. It was part of our training. And so those, we were also teammates. We were also very close, but you know, there were plenty of times too where it got competitive and he allowed it to a certain degree.
Cool. I appreciate that. So that is my next one is Anthony Irvin.
Yeah. You know, I love that guy. I mean, and what he did in the story.
He was just a kid when he came along though.
Yeah, he was, you know, the way Popov identified me early, like he knew right away that I was going to be a contender. I knew Anthony was going to be one of the two or three that I needed to. And he hadn't proven himself. He was totally, but But I could see right away, not just the feel for the water, technique. There's the mentality, and it's there's something. We connected. We were similar in some ways, and so I recognized that in him and knew right away that he was going to be as good as he proved himself to be.
Now, did you feel threatened? Did you take him under your wing, or did you push him aside?
Both, all three, all the above. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we trained together for a while, and most of the time it's a team atmosphere. I was involved in assembling the team and a central figure, and kind of we were all equals. Mike included, and it didn't matter. Anthony was part of that, accepted and included and nurtured. And, but I was describing it earlier too. It's a competitive environment. And I remember there was a flare up before Olympic trials in 2000 where, we got in each other's faces. It was intense.
Just you and Anthony alone?
That one in particular. Yeah. You're going into battle. There's something very primal about asserting dominance in a very violent. Let's face it, we're not beating each other's face in, but it's an explosive, violent event. Where we're, punching against the element of water and inner demons. And, it's intense and just, testosterone and desire to win and dominate that is very instinctual, ancient, primal in each of us that are successful at that level of sport. And so, it rears its ugly head sometimes. I think it happens.
How do you feel about the ultimate result of sharing the gold medal with Anthony in 2000?
I couldn't have written a better script. I mean, I was so first confused looking at the scoreboard and trying to figure out who won and if I had been disqualified, which was an immediate fear. This footage of me after the race where I'm just like squinting hard at the board, like trying to understand, like, did Anthony win or did I win? Like, it took an unreasonably long, probably a total of 5 seconds, but the longest 5 seconds of my entire life, where I'm like trying to piece together that, oh, we tie. And, after that realization, I was just like, put an arm around each other and I jokingly said, oh, it makes perfect sense. We had the same coach. We did the exact same practices every day. We ate the exact same meals. But that was the first time that there had been a tie on the men's side in Olympic history for swimming. And so, couldn't have expected it, but couldn't have been more thrilled with the result.
Do you think at that time, this could be a stupid question, but it could be a tough question as well. But did Anthony overperform then? Did you underperform, or were you just both as good as each other at that point in time?
No, I never second guess like, oh, could I have done better? Like if I had tried just a little bit harder, I could have been standing on top of that medal podium by myself. Shucks, darn it, never. So I was thrilled and with the result and did he underperform? I don't win an Olympic gold medal. Can you say that he underperformed?
Yeah.
Like what, some people, set those standards of expectation on themselves. But no, I was able to enjoy the moment and the results for what they were.
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible performance. It really stunned me. I mean, I was part of that group that competed for that gold medal, and you know, it didn't surprise me that you won for sure. I mean, I was like, okay, makes sense. But Anthony, you know, in a way, came out of nowhere for me because I hadn't seen him training. I didn't know much about Anthony at that stage, and to see him get the result he got was like, wow. I mean, that was, for me, it was incredible. So yeah, but now knowing Anthony and seeing what he's done in his career as well, is, again, we're talking about another legend of the sport. And you know, and in a way the tie makes a lot of sense because of the way that you guys are built. Like you said, you're very similar in a sense, which is odd. Because you're similar in the sense that you're both different than most sprinters. You're just different. You are. I mean, most sprinters are more like me. But most sprinters didn't win Olympic gold like me either. So, I mean, you have to be different to be an Olympic gold medalist. So that's what makes you great. When I look at you and Anthony, I think to myself, wow, that these two guys could do things that I just couldn't do. You know, that's kind of the way I put it down. I just, a lot of people think, could you have won the gold medal? You know, they ask me, could you have won it? And I'm always content with where I finished because I felt like I got beat by guys that were better than me. I mean, that's the bottom line. You guys were better than me in many different facets. And so I think that you were utterly deserving of the gold medal. And it kind of comes back to that. I know I'm rambling here, but it comes back to that argument of anybody can win the 50 freestyle. And I just don't think that's the case.
No, that's not the case. I mean, there's, yeah, it's not the case. In terms of addressing how Anthony and I are different, so we survived a system that drives the most talented athletes from the sport of swimming. That so the fastest horses aren't the ones that win the Kentucky Derby. The fastest horses never had a saddle on. And Anthony and I are wild horses, you know, and the system tries to break you the way bucking Bronco busters go in and break a horse, you know? And if you talk to those people, that's what they're doing. They're trying to break them psychologically, to control them. They ultimately want them to run fast, but they want to control it. And if there was a jockey riding on my back, I would have kicked him off a long time ago. You know, like, I wasn't going to let that happen, and neither was he. That we had to have faith in the people that we were working with, and that was Mike, but Mike wasn't trying to jockey us, you know, ride us like that, or break us down psychologically, or inhibit our freedom, ability to have a life outside of the sport or other outside interests, or, you know, it's a control thing. That so many coaches make the mistake of trying to control because they're trying to build a formula, right? Like, you do this set on Monday, this date, and they've got 4-6 months of workouts planned, and they're trying to, like, fine-tune this mathematical formula to get X result, and it's not. Racing is not a formula. You have sports science data people that try to make it that way, but in order to be good at it, it's being present, and it's a feeling. It's art, not science, if you do it right. And Anthony and I both understood that in an innate way and had to fight and fight and fight so much opposition through so many years in order to remain in the sport. And most any other talented swimmer gives up and goes to a different sport. The smart ones do. and I just stuck it out, and so did Anthony. I retract that. Actually, Anthony took a he buggered off, right? Like for a lot of years, because he didn't, he couldn't conform to the confines, to the demands and the expectations and stuff like that. It's all the structured regimen, like it was not appealing to who he is as a person, who I am as a person. And so, I don't know. I think that that is probably some of the differences that Anthony and I shared outside of some of the other sprinters. And, you know, I can name a lot of great sprinters who are the same. Mark Foster was a guy who walked, you know, he walked to the beat of his own drum, you know, and took a lot of shit for it, from his federation, from media, from teammates, coaches. And so, I don't know. I don't think that we're exceptional. I think that there's quite a few athletes out there that just aren't the robot.
Well said, mate. I'm glad you put it the way you articulate it, the way exactly the way I think it, but you articulated it perfectly. So thank you. I do want to touch on a subject that is a little touchy, and you probably talked about it a few times, but I know that there's a story to it, and I don't think everybody knows the full story. So you've told me previously, but I want to just put out a phrase and then you can kind of go into the backstory. But this one is smash them like guitars.
Yeah. Yeah. I cringe when I hear it, especially in an Australian accent.
Sorry.
Sorry. I'm not holding that against you. I'm holding it against the entire nation of Australia.
But I know the full story. There's a really good story to it. There's a different side of the story. Yeah. Let's say that.
Yeah. So it was a quote that was taken by the Australian media out of context, from what I argue to be the most flattering article about Australian swimming ever written. It was, most of the article was saying how the United States swimming, which I was at odds with. Really, I struggled with the leadership of USA Swimming for a long time. And so this was an article that was written in CNN, Sports Illustrated, and it was on and on about all the things that Australian, because the Institute of Sport, Don Talbot, who just passed away, was at the reins, and the innovative things that he was doing, how they were professionalizing opportunities for the swimmers, and how their federations were working to promote the swimmers. And you know, it was just such a different, you know, that if you were a top level swimmer in Australia, you were treated as a celebrity. Like you, and that just wasn't the case here. I mean, there were, you know, swimmers that were just living on breakfast cereal and pizza crusts, you know, to get to Olympic trials, and top swimmers on the national team doing that. And so that's where my head was at when writing this article. And there was one quote in it where I was like, you know, in my biased opinion, I think that we'll smash them like guitars. The United States has always risen to the occasion, and this will be no exception, but we've got our work cut out for us. Like, it's not going to be so easy this time. And, you know, if I can wish Australia well in the process and not have them step on our heads, than I do. You know, so it was what I thought a very thoughtful, and perhaps that's what hurt the most. We flew to Australia after qualifying for the team, and we touched down, and like somebody shoves a newspaper. I hadn't even gotten off the airplane. Somebody shoves the newspaper into my chest hard and says, "What have you done?" Like, and the cover of the newspaper says, "We're going to smash them like a guitar." And it's got my face, like, giant, and like big mouth is like the quote underneath it. And again, talking earlier about NBC and their difficult task of like creating the personas, like I was selected by Australian media as the guy that was going to be the ugly American, you know, just the basically Rodney Dangerfield. Of the sport. And what really hurt was that it was such a nice article about Australian swimming. And I was, for probably 2 weeks, the most hated man in Australia. And I thought it was so unfair. It tarnished my reputation in the sport horribly, and those damages were real. And now, yeah, I mean, even to this day, I was joking about, like, when I hit, I'll be in a bar or a public place, and I'll hear, "Smash him like a guitar." That's a terrible
some bad awesome.
But that's how I'm recognized, and I still have to listen to it. You got me. Yeah, that's fine. Oh, there was an article. It was actually complimentary. No, never mind.
Forget it. So tell me this then. Why did you volunteer then to anchor the relay, or was that chosen upon you? How did that come about?
Yeah, I was an anchor leg swimmer. I was having a great meet. At trials leading into it. And that was my blood sugar, which is a diabetes related thing, was really, really high for that race. I was new to a year and a half into diabetes management. I didn't have it mastered. Nobody ever masters it. But my levels were off for that race. I've never told anybody about that, but it definitely, I swam well, swam faster than Ian Thorpe. People don't remember that I dove in, body length behind. And none of that takes away from the respect that I have for the Australian team. They outperformed us that night, all of us. It was a great race. It was a great race. I was outtouched at the wall, and so have had to live with that. Some of the things that, you wish you could go back and change. I don't think that we failed, like we were under the world record. It wasn't like somebody dropped the ball or you messed up. That would have stung, but it was still a close enough race that, I definitely, those are the ones that, we all have races that we lost by just a little, a little bit that push us to do better.
Hey guys, I've been trialing some revolutionary new swim tech, and now you can get your hands on it too. This is EO Swim Better, a swimming evolution in the palm of your hands. Improve your technique with EO Swim Better.
Analyze your stroke technique with EO's Swim Better handset. Go to eolab.com, use code Brett at checkout, and save 10%. I interviewed Jason Lezak on the podcast, and we spoke, and he had talked about the fact that you and him were never really on great terms. Maybe even during that relay, was there a feeling that the team wasn't united enough to win that race?
I mean, is that what he suggested?
Certainly by 2004, that's what he suggested, that there was, we can talk about 2004, but maybe even during 2000, do you feel like you were united at for that relay at least? Do you feel like you guys had a strong sense of team?
No, because of Jason and I. Yeah, I mean, and I respected him, but he wanted what Papa and I had, and I felt like he wanted that rival. He wanted to create that rivalry with me. He was a very talented up and coming swimmer, not yet proven himself the way he did ultimately. What I knew that he was capable of in 2008 and that incredible relay performance, but he wanted a rivalry, and it wasn't so much driven from him. His agent, Evan Morgenstein, and my agent, Dave Arluck, probably had more to do with fueling that than Jason and I. And I didn't really, it wasn't that I didn't respect Jason. I just chose not to focus on it. You know, like I was doing my own thing. I had, you know, clear goals of my own. I just didn't want to play a game like that with him.
Yeah.
Leading up to the Olympics. And so we had a little bit of, you know, weirdness between he and I. And he's a good guy and he was a great swimmer and I respect him. I respect him. But were we totally united on that relay? No.
So in that sense,
let me finish by saying, do I think that it prevented us from winning? No. I think that we gave an outstanding performance. I think that if we had been a tenth of a second faster, that Australia would have been 1.1 tenth of a second faster. You know, it comes down to racing. And so maybe the times would have been different, but they were better racers in the pool.
Yeah. And it happens, you know, it happens sometimes. You can't win them all, but certainly a great race. There's no doubt about that. But were you then able to, is it easier for you to put that loss aside because you don't have a strong connection necessarily with all of the teammates on that relay to then go into your individual performances and have the performance that you had, like a winning performance? Because most people would be crushed by that, feeling like I anchored that relay. Maybe there's some responsibility there. You know, I'm just being honest with you. Maybe that would crush some other people. But for you, you were then able to then go on and have incredible individual performances.
No, it was a humiliation. I mean, you remember, I mean, the Australian media that teed up that rivalry thing and took that quote out of context seized the opportunity and just delighted in the Schadenfreude like way of humiliating me, you know, and what, you know, American loudmouth served humble pie, that type of stuff. Like, eat this, you know, and just.
Were you reading this stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's all over. I mean, come on. Every single newspaper was just like, oh, yeah, you know, Sebastian, like, guitarist guy. All the pictures on the papers where the Aussies on top of the blocks strumming air guitars and stuff like that. So, yeah, I wasn't, you know, able to avoid that. And so, yeah, I mean, I had to, you know, be dealing with that and trying to pull myself together for my next race, which was like the following night. That was the 100 freestyle. And I out-touched Michael Klim, who broke the world record in the leadoff of that 4x100 freestyle relay, you know, the night before. By a hundredth of a second. I kept him off the medal podium by getting a bronze in the 100 freestyle. And I had no business being on that podium. I had no business being in the finals, really. I mean, with the diagnosis and the time out of the pool, I wasn't even qualified. I didn't have my Olympic trials time standard until the last day before Olympic trials, the cutoff. And we were at a meet and Mike's like, swim the 100 free. What have you got to lose? I made the cutoff for trials, went to trials thinking it was going to be like a warm up for my 50 and qualified for the team. And just, I didn't belong up there. Peter Van Den Hoogenband, like that guy's not easy to beat. Popov, you know, those are the other guys on the, and me, who was never, you know, really the strongest 100 swimmer. Even before being diagnosed with diabetes and becoming the first person with that condition to make an Olympic team, like proud moments, proud medals in my career, that 100 freestyle. One, because it just took true grit to get it. you know, and because it was on the tail end of all of that fallout from the relay and the media, and having to pull myself together and recover from that and refocus. That made me really proud that I was able to do that.
Beautiful, man. Yeah, I love it. You mentioned a few people there, and you mentioned the performance that you had. So I'm always interested in the ready room. And when I had moments where I was in the Olympic final and I walked into the ready room, some of my thoughts were, oh shit, there's Gary Hall Jr. You know, when Gary Hall Jr. walks into the ready room, what are you thinking when Popoff is there and Peter Van den Hoogenben's there and Michael Klim's there, and you're about to have this performance that is going to, that you feel like you have no business getting, like, what are you thinking during that period of time?
So I mentioned earlier that if there's eight finalists, there's two or three that you have to really, you know, I knew. And maybe it's just that being that many years in the sport, you can size it up. And I heard on your podcast with Jack Roach, he said something really interesting, where he was talking about, like, before, behind the starting blocks, that you could see the people's eyes darting and stuff like that. And where, the thoughts, the negative thoughts, when they come in to an opponent's head, like, you can see them, like, their eyes start, like, you said something to that effect. And that's true. Like, I could walk into a ready room and just look at the faces of the other competitors in there and immediately rule out four just from the look in their eyes.
Sure.
There's a lot of psychology to it. And, and an ability to read other people too.
Makes sense.
So I was good at that. I was good at that. I knew. And in terms of the psychology part of it too, and I had contingency plans. I knew beforehand what I could say to somebody if I felt like I needed the advantage that would take them out of their game. And it wasn't in a mean way, but I knew that if in 2004 in the ready room, Roland Schumann was one of the guys that I had to focus on. And I knew exactly what to say to him if I felt like I needed. And I went in and I read him and I didn't say it. I didn't say it. I felt like I knew this as a friend. It's not a mean thing to say. I was going to say, Roland, your dad would be really proud. And that was going to give me an advantage that would have completely taken him out. I knew him well enough that something that innocent, innocuous, would have had enough in a sport measured to the hundredth of a second to
That's that. Interesting. And I'm glad you brought up that ready room, because I do want to talk to you about that ready room.
Yeah. And then, yeah, a lot more happened in that ready room before Athens. But, so I don't know. It's a game. It's competitive, and I was able, to, for the most part, respect my competitors. Didn't need to indulge the mind games, but I definitely was reading. I mean, yeah, I was sizing people up.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. Well, let's jump forward to 2004. You have your win in 2000, and you're the 53 champion. But 2004 is different. You're coming in and you feel like you're not at your best, but you have, we all know this iconic robe that you wore out for the final in 2004. But there's certainly some backstory to it, and even the moments before you walk out leading up to that, there was some incidents going on there. So talk to us about the robe itself and what happened in 2004.
Yeah, so I was wearing bathrobes to the pool, and my grandfather, who I admired, loved, I'd go swimming with him as a kid. I used to wear a bathrobe to the pool. And so, you know, I didn't think bathrobes were anything unusual, and I continued to wear them through my career. And in 2000, Everlast, leading into the trials, Everlast recognized that we were wearing these terry cloth bathrobes, and they sent us a bunch of like boxer kind of terry cloth robes. And so I had this customized, the CEO of Everlast through Dave Arluck, says, there's this woman in Brooklyn, she's been making boxing robes for Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier dating back, you know, to the 70s. We'd like to make you a customized boxing robe. And so I said, sure, that sounds incredible. I'm stoked, you know, and they made this like very flashy silk, like stars and stripes robe, and sent it, you know, emblazoned with my name across the back and stuff like that. And I'm wearing it to Pan American Games, to Nationals, to like some of the big meets and stuff leading up to the games. And I get to the games and say, hey, look, I go to the national team guy, Everett Uchiyama, who's gone from the sport, safe sport regulations, lifetime ban. Like, he wasn't a great guy. He was molesting kids. We didn't know that at the time, but I go to him, I say, hey, listen, I know that there's a uniform policy, and that sponsors pay a lot of money, and I want to honor that. I'll wear the uniform, and I'd like to wear the robe that I've been wearing out to all the major competitions that I've been doing, Pan American Games and stuff like that. You know, to the blocks, I'll leave it open so that you can see the sponsor logo underneath. And he says, no, absolutely not. You can't do that. So I knew that I was going to. Immediately, I didn't tell him that. I said, okay, fine. I go back to the room, I roll up my robe, I put it in the towel, I roll up the towel, I go to the pool, warm up, I go to the ready room, I go into the ready room, they take the credentials, nobody's allowed in there except for the swimmers, no coaches, no trainers, no national team directors. And once I'm in there, I put on my goggles, I put on the robe. And within a minute, Everett is there at the thing. He's trying to like talk to the security people. And he's like, let me in. I got to go talk to the swimmer. He's wearing that robe. Like, I don't know if he is. And I'm just like watching him. He's like, Gary, come here. And I just smiled and like shook my head. Like, no, I'm past the point of no return on this one. I'm not going back. Like, there's nothing you can do. Like, you can't stop me. Like, and he lost his mind. He absolutely like unraveled. Like, spittle was flying out of his mouth. He's like screaming. He was like trying to like reach over the security guards who had to like restrain him and carry him away. Like screaming at me, like reaching toward me, like he was going to choke me. Like, and I was just sitting there watching this whole thing unravel, and all the other swimmers like they were there, you know, saw a little bit of this like scuffle thing happen. It was over in like a minute, and then he's carried away kicking and screaming, and they're like, okay, finalist 50 freestyle, walk out to the box. And I knew that I was going to be in a lot of trouble after the race.
Wow, well, that's a lot to carry, because I think I had an incident with you, not an incident, but we had an interaction probably right before that. So I was actually the first person into the ready room, and I was sitting there. I was nervous, but I felt fairly controlled. I felt relaxed, but I was certainly the first one there. And by my surprise, I just like to get there early and kind of get focused and get centered. And then the second person into the ready room was you. You'd already had your cap and goggles on, and you had the robe on at this stage. So I must have missed you putting it on. And then you walked over to me and you congratulated me on breaking the Australian record the night before. And you shook my hand. And you said, go get it again, buddy. Good luck, you know? And, And that was, for me, that was very respectful, very nice. But I'm sure it was just part of the interaction in the ready room for you in terms of, you know, reaching the room, you know, and getting a temperature of where everybody's at. And so I'm sure you could probably read me at that stage.
I always wanted to be respectful. I always did respect the other swimmers. And a lot of times those interactions were very positive.
Yeah.
And I wanted the same that I stated about the Australian team, like without stepping on my head, I wish you all the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm out to beat you, but I want you to do really well. Let's do it really well.
Yeah.
Hey Brett, I'm so sorry. I gotta go. I had no idea this was, I've got an appointment, lesson showing up here.
No problem at all, my friend. No problem at all. I appreciate your time. This has been fantastic.
You want me to circle back and we can do finishes later or something? Or?
We might come back for a part two. Don't worry about that. We'll put this out and people demand more. I'm sure of it. So, but even just this time, man, it's been the longest podcast I've had ever. So I really appreciate your time. This is a dream for me. So thank you for getting inside your head a little bit. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Gary. Take care, bud.